Where everybody knows your name. What's your favorite movie that prominently features alcohol?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with The Philadelphia Story, which gave us the immense cinematic gift of a drunk and talkative Jimmy Stewart.
I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I say Cocktail, for liquor acrobatics, but mostly for Elizabeth Shue circa 1988.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going with Sideways, because I am not drinking any fucking Merlot.
Hi, I'm John Ratzenberger, and the movie I picked as one of the most memorable drinking scenes was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, where, Black Dog comes to the tavern right at the beginning of the movie, and they're all singing 15 Men on a Dead Man's Chest, and I select that as the most memorable drinking scene in the film.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino, episode 138 for Tuesday, November 5th, 2013.
So as people can tell, today Operation Kino is very, very glad to have a guest in John Ratzenberger, actor, host, does it all pretty much. And we're having John on, and we want to talk about what he's here to talk about right away up front first. John, you are currently running a campaign, a Fund Anything campaign, which is, I guess, like a Kickstarter. It's like an Indiegogo. It's crowdfunding for a project that you're doing called American Made, which is very interesting to us. We were talking about the project before the podcast, because we're interested about how things get made in America. I guess that's the point of the show and what that really means, why it's important that we see product, whether it's entertainment, the television shows, the movies you've worked on in the past, made in America, or just anything made in America. So can you tell us a little about what you're campaigning for with this American-made television show, and what's your grand ambition here?
Well, the grand ambition is to save Western civilization. falling short of that, to me it's just simple math. I guess, and I don't know whether they stop teaching civics in schools, but if you don't have manufacturing in America, that means your taxes go through the roof because someone's got to pay. For the firemen and the playgrounds and the schools. So the more you support American made, the better your schools are going to be, the safer your neighborhoods are going to be, and then on down the line, the more smooth the roads are going to be, because those big factories pay a lot of money into City Hall. And when they go, because we think we're getting a break with this cheaper T-shirt that is made overseas, when they go, all that tax dollars, all those tax dollars come out of your pocket. And I don't think people realize that. They think they're getting a break. Like, oh, boy, these shoes are, $20 cheaper. Well, great, but your tax bill just went up $350. But the other sense that I'm going with is the fact that we're losing the skills. It used to be normal, especially for men, to have these skills. And, now they're called Renaissance men, but back, 40 years ago, it was just the average guy. It's fix his car, build a bookshelf, do a little plumbing here and there and just be handy. And somehow we've bred that out of our children because we don't have shop classes anymore in schools. We don't teach kids the art of using tools. And that's a danger because the average age of people that can built things right now in the United States is 58 years old. So really what I want to do is I want to celebrate not only the products, they talk about a grand ambition, not just the products and how they're made, but the people who make them, and to dispel the myth that they're not as smart as a lot of other people. They're actually smarter.
Do you think, and I would throw this to Dave and Katie too, I'm curious about when I was watching your video for the Fund Anything campaign, I'm seeing all these people do these amazing things. And by amazing things, I mean simple things too, just like building things in factories and constructing, like you're saying. You don't see a lot of that, and you want to. You want to know that it takes labor, it takes passion to be able to do that, and smarts, intelligence. I often wonder if we see that in entertainment at all too. We don't see a lot of movies and television shows, and I think we used to, but we not as much anymore, about those kind of people and those kind of jobs. And I wonder why, or maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe we do see a lot of that, or American Made could fill that gap in some way.
Well, you do see it, but people that work in factory are always depicted as being stupid. Like Gomer Pyle, for instance, he was a master mechanic, but he was depicted as being an idiot. Officer and a gentleman, you know, he had to come and rescue her from working in a factory. And the people that work in factories, I mean, you have to be an artist to take a hunk of metal and by hand hone it down to within 1/10,000th of an inch calibration in order to make a piece of something else. And these people do it every single day. And if you screw that up, that costs a company a lot of money. I grew up in it. And I guess that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I always, as a kid, those were my heroes. I mean, there are people, just regular neighborhood people, that could build or fix anything. And there was never a 1-800 van pulling into the neighborhood. If you could fix it, your father, your uncle, or somebody else, then you go to one of the neighbors and you trade off these skills. And that's just the way it was all those years ago. But that's changed. And but movies, because also don't forget, the people that make the movies, they're not necessarily handy. It's not like they had jobs of roofing a house. Whereas back in the golden age of Hollywood, the people that came to Hollywood then, back in the early 50s, I'd say, don't forget, they came out of a depression. Economic depression and holes in their shoes, and they fought a world war, and so they had a lot of game that they brought to the art. They had a lot of information, they had a lot of experiences in their lives that they were able to bring to the art form of movies or television, whatever it was. And I think we've lost sight of that of what it takes to actually work. To be a carpenter or a plumber, and it goes across political boundaries too. Because on Super Bowl Sunday, when your toilet backs up, the plumber shows up. You don't ask him whether he's a Democrat or Republican. That guy's a hero.
He does not want to show up at my house on Super Bowl Sunday. I'm going to tell you that much. Not the toilet. Woof.
Well, you're gonna pay for it. That's for sure.
What I really enjoyed about seeing the American Made campaign is I really want there to be some sort of raised awareness of this particular type of skilled work, because I feel like in America, both in the entertainment industry and in the skilled workers industry, there's really been a loss of sort of the thought of apprenticeship, or the idea that if you could go out and work really hard to learn a specific skill, that there will be a job that you could later take over. And, that these are American jobs that are being passed down among skilled workers. So not only do you have Renaissance men, but you have a certain amount of job security that you wouldn't have, and especially this current economy with the weirdness of college graduates. It seems like raising. Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, the jobs are there right now. There's according to Deloitte, the survey they did just recently, there's 600,000 jobs available in manufacturing right now, right now, today. But when kids get out of high school, you know, they've been told all these years that, well, you got to go to college. And so nobody bothered to show them the skills necessary. I mean, it's simple things like reading a ruler. The average high school graduate, show them a yardstick or any measurement tape, say point to 7 3/4 inches, and they can't do it.
Wow.
Which is astounding. Which is just astounding. But
there's an app for that or something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, there you go. Or why? What would they ever had to have measured in all their school career? The only place, unless you do it at home, unless you're a tinkerer or your family does it, it was the shop class or home ec. You know, you measured out things, and so you get a sense of fractions and algebra and geometry and angles and degrees. But you got hands-on experience in that before you got to fractions and in math class.
Yeah,
so you understood it better.
And it fosters a curiosity in a very practical way, which I think is a great thing to be putting on TV, because, you know, we have a ton of shows about what you do when you think you're a good singer, but we don't have anything that shows anything sort of practical. And so that's what I'm enjoying with American Made. Patches, I think you...
Yeah, I wanted to wrap up with one more question for you, John, and everybody, really. I'm curious about... Now, you have worked on many big movies and television shows, and, you know, having worked in production myself, I feel like I have an understanding of how many artisans go into making a movie. And I'm wondering if American Made in some way applies to the entertainment industry. Are we losing something by not having these... you know, woodworkers and designers and artisans here working on the movies? You were talking a little before we started the podcast about going off and shooting, you know, a Star Wars movie in London or overseas somewhere. You know, do we need these movies to come home, or can we shoot movies anywhere and it doesn't really matter? Or does this apply?
Well, movies, I mean, it's been great for me these last, you know, 100 years or however long I've been doing it. But don't forget, we're not essential. Entertainers, you know, people can entertain themselves with shadow puppets and banjos. You know, basketball celebrities are not essential. The people that are essential, the people that, you know, make sure that the water comes out of your faucet, the electricity courses down those wires every day, and the people that build and tend the turbines.
But the movies do provide a lot of money. They have, I mean, they make a lot of money for people working on them.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely they do. And also, but on movie sets, the average age is getting up there too of those people. But not so much, because I think there's younger people are so attracted to that, to the movie world, that there's always a big influx of young people. And but, you know, the carpenters, the set builders, they're running into the same problem of, you know, people not having the basic skills when they show up.
We should probably devote a segment of this podcast to actual doing things from now on, as opposed to just talking about them. I'm starting to realize that. John, so fund anything campaign. I believe it's just fundanything.com/American Made. You're raising money for the show. Is the show going to be on the web? Is it going to be on television? Where's the end goal for that?
Well, all the above. It'll be on the web at first, but then we'll go on TV.
Awesome.
We're already, you know, talking to some of the networks, and you know, as long as they don't have to spend the money to make it, they're good.
They're happy. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you.
I can't find it. It doesn't seem to be on any of these stations.
Keep looking.
Oh, you're going too slow. Let me take the wheel.
It's too fast. How could you even tell what's on?
I can tell.
Back.
Too late, I'm in the 40s. Gotta go around the horn. Faster.
Wait, stop.
I look for the giant.
So as big fans of you, John, we and as younger people, I guess, one of the first movies I saw in theaters was Toy Story. So that I'm giving you my age.
You're
I'm giving it away.
Yourself.
I really am dating myself here. Not one of maybe not one of the
that
first
was
movies.
15 years ago.
Yeah, it's getting it's up there.
Almost.
I'm not young anymore. I'm not a young man. I'm getting up there in age. And I was also happy to see that one of the prizes you're giving away for Fund Anything was a limited edition autographed Ham the Pig Pez dispenser that you're signing. And that kind of warmed my heart. And it just reminded me how much of an impact you've made through your continued work with Pixar. You are an essential component. People wonder, who is John Ratzenberger playing in the next Pixar movie? That's a big scoop. and I don't know if you knew that, but it definitely is. So just right off the bat.
I didn't. That's fun.
Definitely.
If you tell us who the next one is, then we'll have to
Yeah. Who are you playing in whatever the next Pixar? What is the next Pixar movie, Katie? You know.
I think it's going to be Inside Out.
Yeah, now that Good Dinosaur has been kind of like moved ahead, I think. Are you in Inside Out, John? Are you one of the people?
I assume that I am. I just wait for the call. It's literally no one's ever said would sign papers. It's just I get a call. They go, "Oh, we got a great part for you," and then they tell me where to show up, and I record and enjoy the heck out of it. It's like being invited to play in the sandbox with the coolest kid on the block. and it's just such a treat when they call and say, "Hey, come on, play in our sandbox." You bet. I'm there.
How did that relationship start then? I mean, I guess it was your typical casting process for Toy Story, but when was the moment when you just became the recurring guy for Pixar? Who loves you? Is it John Lasseter?
That's a John Lasseter, Andrew Stanton question, really. I wasn't part of that process. I mean, I didn't make him any promises or pledge to cut their lawn every Saturday.
But you do anyway, because you're a nice guy.
I show up on time, and so far I haven't broken any furniture, so they keep asking me, and I keep showing up.
Now, I've talked to people who have voiced animated characters before who say that when they meet children who, may be fans of Toy Story or another Pixar movie, they don't really care about the actor who voices that character. They kind of only want to meet him and not you. Have you experienced this? Do kids have any response to you when they realize that you're the voice of these characters?
Oh, yeah, it depends on the age. Mm-hmm. So a lot of parents make the mistake of, telling a three-year-old, like, "Oh, this is Hammy the Pig." And the three-year-old looks at the parent like, "What are you, nuts? This is not Hammy. It's some guy." But then, once they're 7, 8 years old, then they understand the causality, the voice and the recording, so they're able to understand it. Mm-hmm. But what I do is, I'll be approached by, actually happened yesterday. I was at brunch and people at the table next to us said, our kids love Hammy the Pig and this and that. And I said, "Well, where are they?" They said, "Well, they're home with their aunt or something." I said, "Let's give them a call," because I guess the kids were 5 and 6 years old. I said, "Get them on the phone." And I said, what is it that you want them to do? Like go to bed early or do their homework or, and they said, "Well, tell them to listen to Mommy and Daddy." So I got on the phone. I said, "Hey, Tracy and Judd, this is Hammy the Pig," and apparently it was a big hit. Right? Listen to Mom and Dad.
How could it not be?
You are saving families everywhere.
I get a kick out of it. I mean, I just get a big thrill out of it because here's this kid. It's like being Santa Claus. It's some kid somewhere, and I've done it dozens of times. So there's a lot of kids out there think that Hammy the Pig actually called him.
I'm a huge Pixar fan because I love animation, and I still think that the art of animation ends up being undervalued in terms of what a director can do in the booth or when you're actually working on these movies. I'm curious about, you know, John Lasseter is such an entity at Pixar, and he's kind of risen up the ranks since he started there. I mean, he's kind of overlord of animation at this point at Disney. And but what is John Lasseter director?
Oh, no, yeah, he didn't rise up the ranks. He was the ranks.
He became the ranks.
John, well, no, he 18 years ago when I started with him, you know, John was the boss, but there was only a handful of them working out of an office in Richmond, California, right next to an oil refinery. And
where all great now, creative, you know, things happen.
He's got, well, he's got armies of animators now.
Right.
And also, yeah, he's now in charge of all Disney animation in the Disney parks. But the important thing to me was that in looking at it, and certainly spending the last 18 years with them, is that he's much like Walt Disney in that they're both artists. First, they came to the game, but they're artists.
Right.
They didn't come to it as the business part of show business, even though they understand it, certainly. But first and foremost, John Lasseter is an artist. Oh. And because to be a good artist, your standard has to be very high. If you notice with any Pixar movie, you can watch it 5, 10 times, and you're still going to notice something you hadn't seen in the last 9 times you saw it. Whether it's the way they animate the waves, or the curtain rock, or the clothes blowing in the wind, or whatever it is, there's always something there. And I don't care how many times you see it. So for me, that's why they're always classic, because you're never going to get bored.
But how
always going to see something else.
How would you define John as a director? Like when you're working with him on Toy Story back in 1995, before he's kind of in charge of all these different components, before he's kind of a bigwig at Disney, he's still the guy at Pixar directing the first 3D animated, you know, this CG animated feature. He's an artist. He's a director. What's he like working on a movie as a director?
Well, it's like many good directors. He brings an unmitigated joy with him. It's just part of his DNA. He loves what he does. He loves it. And he gets very excited over the details and explaining it and what goes on. But again, it's a high standard. I don't know if any of you have ever seen like an 8th grade geography test from 1950. You know, Google one up.
Very few. I've seen very few of them. Yeah.
Well, I mean, go online, and I'm sure they're there, but because I've seen them, and most teachers couldn't pass it today. But the point being, back then the standard of education was very high, and the educational system, for whatever reason, lowered the standard, and so most teachers, college graduates, can't answer simple eighth grade geography questions from 1950. Well, Pixar is Pixar because John Lasseter keeps the standard high. They don't rest on their laurels, and they don't slip on the standard, and they work as hard on whatever number of films they've done on this next one as hard as they worked on their first one. And that has never, ever changed. I don't care how many people they got working on it. John sets the standard, and your job is to meet that standard. Much like back in 1950, this is the standard of education, and you're expected to meet it. Now, the rest is up to you, but we're not going to lower the standard just because you're a knucklehead.
When you get the call that they want you to come back in and either contribute like a sequel voice or a new character voice, especially with new characters, how much of the character is are you told versus how much do you get to sort of spontaneously create with the dialogue?
I forget. I mean, it changes each time. I mean, I'll get, you know, they'll give me a hint like it's going to be a French waiter in a restaurant for Ratatouille. And I said, oh, okay. And I'm assuming they want me to use a French accent. And so I go in prepared to do that.
Do you have a French accent? Do you just have one ready for all purposes? I don't know if you've been cast as a Frenchman many times.
No, but I lived in Europe for 10 years. And I think the thing about France is that struck me is that they really do, they laugh, they go, ho, 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 ho. And they really do laugh like that. And I thought that was just a joke. But I remember, you know, going through, when I was in Portic, it's a little town, a seacoast town. And, you know, I was in a bar, cafe, whatever they call it. It was these guys at the end of the bar going, oh, ho, 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 ho. And I started laughing because I thought they were, like, doing a fake French laugh. But there you go. But, no, it's the beauty. That's actually the beauty of Europe, is in England especially, because you can go all through England. 60 miles from London, you've got wide, different accents. You know, in Norfolk, Suffolk and Norfolk, it's, you know, they have a sing-songy accent. It's sort of, have you got the time, boy? Have you got the time? And then you go to Somerset, which is the other way, and they go, you're a Yank, are ye? And that's really, that's those two places are not that far from each other. It'd be like New York and Boston, maybe. But the accents are so incredibly, it's such a wild. And then certainly, you know, in Scotland, you get the, hey, Jimmy, how you putting the boot in my hay? And it's like, wait a second. I just, 2 hours ago, I was with the, in South London, and, the people are saying, feeling a bit peckish, are you, loaf? To me, it's it's so fascinating. I loved all that. So yeah, if I need to do a French accent, I'll do a French accent. Whatever they need.
You rise up and do it. Well, thank you, John, for that.
That's your job. That's your job as an actor. You know, whether it's stage, radio, TV. I mean, you show up. It's like a plumber again. Going back to that.
Yeah,
you got a lot of tools in that bag. You don't know what the job's going to fail, but you better if you call yourself a plumber, you better be ready to fix whatever's broken.
American-made acting.
So it's same thing with an actor. you want to do radio, TV, stage, whatever it is, you better know how to do it.
Excellent. Well, John, I think we're going to.
I like Dancing with the Stars. Sorry.
You love Dancing with the Stars?
Well, that's why I liked it, because I like to dance. And it harkened back to the time when actors did all that. They sang, they danced, they acted. I mean, Jay, have you ever seen that? If you go to YouTube and go to James Cagney, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Oh, yeah, he can really dance.
Oh, can he really dance? Yeah, I mean, you should do that. That's all acting schools should show that. Here's a guy who was known as being a tough guy gangster. And then, here he is doing Yankee Doodle Dandy. He was one heck of a tap dancer.
That was a different era, but again,
the standard was just higher, that's all.
Did you actually learn to dance in when you were studying acting? I mean, were you prepared for Dancing with the Stars?
No, I didn't really go to acting school. Dancing I picked up in high school. Because you had to know how to dance. I mean, I always enjoyed it.
That's awesome.
Back in the early 60s. I just liked dancing. Because it was a factory town. You didn't get much chances to dress up. So I always looked forward to the prom because I got to wear a tuxedo. You felt like somebody, You felt like David Niven or Cary Grant or, like, wow, I'm wearing a tuxedo. So, but anyway, so it's, next time we all meet, we'll go out dancing.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo!
Making your way in the world today takes everything you got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away?
John, I'm sure that you have talked Cheers to death, but in this very short segment that we wanted to put together, I wanted to know if there's anything left that you haven't talked about Cheers. Is there an unturned stone in the Cheers mythology from your – how many seasons were you on the show, first off? 11, right?
11.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Is there something that we still haven't gleaned from the show that we don't understand, that people still don't get about Cheers, now that you can reflect on it?
Oh, tons of things, but I can't, tell those stories.
Oh, John.
I've got some great, great memories, but as soon as I tell them, they're not my memories anymore.
Definitely. I mean, I think it was one of the first shows, at least I remember, at the end of season one, they got Sam and Diane together. So the will they, won't they kind of became more complex. Is there something that you added to Cliff over the years that was sort of came from your personal idea of the character?
Well, Cliff was my idea. There was no Cliff when I walked in for the audition. I invented Cliff in the audition. I was thinking as a writer, because I was writing a lot, and I was writing comedies for the BBC in London, and I was actually in Los Angeles on a writing job. I was writing a comedy based on the life of the Emperor Nero. When the Cheers job came up, I was leaving the room, and I just stopped and turned around. And I said, "Do you have a bar?" "No, at all." And it was Glenn Childs said, what are you talking about? So I just launched into a character that, because I haven't grown up in New England, I mean, every bar has got some horses behind who thinks he knows everything. And that type of person always used to crack me up as a kid. You know, you're sitting there, with your dad, or just back then you could be in a bar 12 years old, nobody really cared. But, listen to these guys expound on some fragment of knowledge. It just always cracked me up. And so I improvised that, and they laughed enough to hire me. So that's how Cliff was invented.
Does Cliff know everything because he reads people's mail? That's what I've always wondered. Being a mailman, I wonder if he knows it all.
That's not very ethical, Patches.
No, definitely not ethical. But I mean,
my friend was Cliff for this Halloween, and his little twist is he would go around reciting facts about Florida, because there was a season where Cliff had gone on vacation and had endless facts about Florida. So it seems like that was his know-it-all piece of character authenticity.
That is strange.
It's very specific.
Well, you see, I fall into that in real life a lot, because I've always thought that there's no such thing as useless knowledge. Mm. Every little tidbit you pick up somewhere down the line, it could be 40 years from now, you're going to use that little bit of knowledge. Who knows where and when? So even, as a kid, I read every word on the cereal box. Every single word, and it's not that I, was trying to get straight A's, which I was a far cry from that. I just wanted to know stuff, and but there was always books around the house too. My dad was a big history buff, so I picked up on that too. And I just yesterday I was explaining to someone how the English archers put an end to the knights, the armored knights on horseback. And it was the Battle of Agincourt. So I was expounding on that, and someone said, "You really are Cliff, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, I guess I am." Because I know stuff like that.
That must come in handy when you're writing comedy, BBC comedies about Nero. That's not the most likely setup.
Well, yeah, I mean... No, Nero, I mean, that almost wrote itself, because he was nuts. He was completely nuts. And after his mother, Agrippina, orchestrated his rise to power as emperor, Nero didn't need her anymore, so he tried to have her killed. And so he was always devising ways to kill his mother. And he had a ship built that would fall apart at sea, hoping she would drown. And to talk to her to take her on a little vacation, and the ship fell apart. It's like it was designed to do, but the captain of the ship swam to shore with the mother, thinking that, well, if I save the emperor's mom, I mean, he'll make me an admiral for sure.
This is a comedy.
Nero cut his head off on the beach instantly, saving his mother's life.
Somewhere in there is comedy, of course.
All my bronze like trash. You'll catch a blast if you move too fast. I talk with class, you don't have to ask. Getting everything by flashing cash. Fighting and stealing, don't kill without feeling. So I went in casinos before they start dealing. All about respect and intellect. Only mess with the women that pick up the check.
So for this last segment, we've opened this the floor up to John Ratzenberger to tell us about a movie that he loves and that we've all watched again in order to discuss. John, you love the movie My Cousin Vinny. Can you tell me a little about why you love My Cousin Vinny so much?
Well, it's really part of the craft. You know, if you were a boat builder and there's one boat that you just think is beautiful, you know, perfectly built, that's what I think about My Cousin Vinny. I just think they do nothing wrong. You know, being in the business for so long, I watch a movie and you kind of instinctively, it's very easy for someone in my business to watch a movie and catch mistakes or thinking, yeah, boy, that actress is probably the girlfriend of the producer or, you know, or they just, boy, they, but My Cousin Vinny, it was perfectly cast. Every scene moves the story along, and it's got a beginning, a middle, an end, and it's funny. It's just, it does its job, and so that's, you know, when I say that's you know, a perfect movie of a movie that you know, anybody would be proud to be part of. I just, you know, never tired of watching it, thinking, okay, you know, there's really nothing wrong with this movie. I mean, the way it was shot, you know, the actors, and it's, you know, Mira Sorvino's, you know, her on the stand there.
Marissa Tomei.
Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, I get her and Mira Sorvino mixed up as well.
They're pretty much the same, yeah. a lot of people
Marissa Tomei, right.
A lot of people give Marissa Tomei crap for winning an Oscar for this movie. But watching it again, I mean, not many people can do what Marissa Tomei does in this movie very well and sell it and sell this kind of like big, broad comedic presence, who is also a little vulnerable.
Yeah, I grew up with people like that. So to me, it was so spot on. And even the first attorney that the other cousin hired, unfortunately, I forget the actor's name, but God, was he funny.
Yeah, it was the nervous guy
with the stutter.
Yeah. And it's just so, there's very few films, you know, you can say that about, but that's one of them. And it was pure entertainment. And they didn't, it wasn't dirty. It was, you know, they didn't go below the belt. And they kept the standard high. And you could sit there and watch it with your kids and not white knuckle the furniture. You know, a very similar one was, in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, the few sections there you don't want to watch with young kids. But even that, it's just beautifully made. And, you know, A Christmas Story is like that, too.
Definitely.
You know, the Red Water. Bob Clark directed that, based on a Gene Shepard story. And again, a really good movie. You know, they weren't big blockbusters, but a good, solid, solid film.
I was talking to Patches before because he had not seen My Cousin Vinny, and this is his first experience.
This was my first time watching the movie, believe it or not.
but how great it is to have a comedy that includes broad performances, but they aren't too broad. And like you were saying, where each scene moves the story forward. So you have these these characters that come off as, you know, very broad, and then each scene reveals another layer. So not only is it Joe Pesci's first time trying grits, but later on that becomes a key thing in the case, and you realize that everything you sort of were laughing at was a contribution to the overall plot. It's they don't make them like they used to.
See, it's interesting to me that you thought that they were broad characters, because I know people like that. To me, it's almost a documentary. Because where I grew up, go there today and can introduce you to people that are just like that. And it's not an exaggeration. It's now, just who they are.
Have you been to the South and had this kind of experience? Do they look at you like you have three heads, like they do in My Cousin Vinny?
Early on when I was in college going through the South, you seem to be, the cops would stop you every 10, 15 miles when they saw you had a license plate from the North. I enjoyed going through the South. I went on a motorcycle trip a few years ago, New York to Las Vegas.
And
spent a lot of that going through, Arkansas and Mississippi. And I just enjoy it. Wherever I am, I just find people fascinating. But no, I think because of TV and films, everybody gets it now.
Yeah. You had the benefit of being on a TV show, a comedy that was really well revered, and it got a lot of awards. And television, I think, comedy gets rewarded, but it, like we were talking about with Marissa Tomei and her Oscar win, it doesn't seem like film comedies get appreciated in the same way by awards or by critics. As someone who has a background in comedy, do you think that that's true? Do you think that there isn't enough critical or awards appreciation for comedies like My Cousin Vinny that are just really, really great?
I've never given that any thought. I don't know. I enjoy watching the award shows, but I think at the end of the day, if something's good, people will go and pay money to see it, and the actor will do it again. One of my current favorites is Melissa McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. She's incredibly talented.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It just cracks me up. And her with Sandra Bullock in that last one they did, I think it's called Heat.
Mm-hmm. So you saw that one?
It's good.
It's really good.
These are two people who know what they're doing.
It's interesting. It's interesting that you bring up the Heat, because I kind of thought about the movie during My Cousin Vinny. Again, this was the first time I had seen this movie. And My Cousin Vinny, we were talking before, John, you were on the show about Jonathan Lynn, who directed this film. Actually, a few weeks ago, we got to talk to another director who loves his movie Clue. And Clue is a very broad, slapsticky comedy. It is a romp, so to speak. And My Cousin Vinny isn't quite that. It's more naturalistic, which is... can be dangerous when you start playing with really broad ideas. Like in the first 20 minutes of this movie, everything that goes wrong because people seem to just not say what they're talking about, which I think is just very odd but very funny. But you have to buy into it a little bit. Like Ralph Macchio doesn't know that he's being interrogated about murder, and yet he keeps answering the questions. Yes, I did it. Yes, my buddy and I were all in on it.
Yeah.
Later, Joe Pesci is interrogating him in the prison and saying, he's getting dangerously close to raping this boy in prison, and the boy's like, and he's just talking to him about the legal case, and it's just like people not talking. That's a hard thing to sell in a movie, and it might feel really goofy in the moment. But it seems to play even in this naturalistic setting. It just feels very it's very balanced, and I think that's a lot on Jonathan Lynn in this movie.
Well, you play those scenes for real. You don't play it for the comedy. That Joe Pesci's character was talking about the case, And the other kid was interpreting it as, oh, my God, you know, this guy's going to assault me. And you just play those emotions for real. And, you know, that's the mastery of the director putting that together. But you keep it at the same volume, keep it the same intensity, and you can cook it on the same stovetop.
Does that mean you never worry about if a comedic bit is landing? Is it really never on an actor's shoulders? I mean, why does My Cousin Vinny play and so many other comedic movies falter in this respect, don't seem to have a grasp on tonality or an ability to convey this comedic stuff? I mean, to kind of put our suspension of disbelief to rest here, that we buy into My Cousin Vinny. It's really not on the actor.
No, I mean, it is on the actor, but, you know, if the actors are playing it too broadly, or if they, you know, are not, you know, the timing could be off, the editing could be off, the lighting could be off, the camera angle might be wrong. I mean, there's so many elements to go into it to come up with a good one. It's like winning the lottery in a lot of ways, because when you think of all the choices the editor had and the music that goes along with it, that's where the magic happens. It's, you know, before the film is shot and after it's shot, it's where all the hard work comes. But it's again, you know, the director's job is to say to the actor, okay, just like that, but half, you know, or give me that again, but twice as much, or, you know, don't look into the camera when you do that. Whatever it is, that's when they have a director. And, you know, my favorites, and you're familiar with John Cleese.
Of course.
Assuming. Well, he and I actually had a conversation because we were both influenced by the same comic actor named Jacques Tati.
Oh, of course. Playtime.
Yeah, you're right. And Mr. Hulot's Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But for someone now to watch that, someone of this era, it's very slow. But when you watch it, and you're not in any hurry, just watch this guy move, just him walking across the room is hysterical. And actually, the socks of Cliff, that character in Cheers, was a homage to Jacques Tati, because the pant legs of my mailman uniform, I had them hike it up an extra 2 or 3 inches so you could see my white socks. And that came from Jacques Tati.
That is a great Cheers tidbit that I feel like I've never heard before.
I haven't told a lot of people that.
To wrap up our conversation on My Cousin Vinny, you mentioned The Heat, but I'm curious about any other more recent comedies that you kind of think lives up to the My Cousin Vinny example of a comedy that just hits every beat and does every single thing right.
You know, when they asked me to think about that, that's the first thing that came to my mind was Cousin Vinny. But again, Heat, you know, it depends. You know, Will Ferrell's funny. You know, and that newscaster character he does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the beauty of that is they don't just go broad, they go to outer space.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and you just take it for what it is. I mean, say, okay, we're having a gang war like the Sharks and the Jets with newscasters. You know, and Brick kills a guy.
You know, with the trident.
Yeah. Okay. You know, they played it all for real. Mm-hmm. They didn't play it broad. This is like they were really in that fight. So, okay, I'm right there with you. And I think that's, you know, that's the key to a lot of good comedies is just play it for real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the situation will be funny and the lines will be funny. But also in comedy, a lot of the comedy lives between the words. Laurel and Hardy, you know, when they put all that together, they really understood that, especially the editor and the director.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, the words are funny, but it's the expression or the glance that's where the laughter lived. And I'm a firm believer of that.
So I whacked them both and left them floating in a pond. Custom made clothes from head to toe. Catch Joe at the fight sitting in the first row. Everybody follows when I'm ready to go. No need to show off, they already know I'm a wise guy. I'm a wise guy.
That does it for today's Operation Kino. We'll be back on Friday with a review of Thor the Dark World. Thank you to our guest, John Ratzenberger. His Fund Anything campaign is for American-made. Patches, you have the exact URL handy, I think.
Yes, it's fundanything.com/American-made, and he's has a lot of fun prizes. I must say, this he has Gator Ron sauce. I'm not sure what's in it, but it looks delicious. And just a number of incredible prizes. A fedora? Like, I just... I look at a lot of Kickstarters and Fund Anythings and crowdsourcing projects. I'm just like, I never get to see fun prizes. And of course, John Ratzenberger has the most fun prizes. So go check it out.
And you can get a Tervis Tumblr with his autograph in it. I have a Tervis Tumblr. It is great.
So. There should be an award for an hour-long phone call just talking to John Ratzenberger after what we just experienced.
Oh, my God. Everyone that should be great. So lucky as to experience such a thing. So thank you again to John Ratzenberger. And go help out his American Made campaign. In the meantime, you two fools, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, rogue agent of the internet. I am writing everywhere and putting it all on mattpatches.com. And I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And remember, if you want to be part of the show, just like John Ratzenberger, you can. You can sing about Vikings and you can do all sorts of things by calling us on the phone. We have a phone. It's 914-410-6450. Contribute somehow. We call to arms here.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell that first part D-A-7-E, which is also my Twitter handle. And you could find me writing about the Aether and why. Is it how you pronounce it, guys?
No, they call it the Aether. They call it the Aether in Thor the Dark World, but it is spelled Aether, A-E-T-H-E-R.
I haven't seen it yet, but I do know that it has lasting implications for the rest of the Marvel Universe. You could find out why at Latino-Review.com. That was my plug. But as for the podcast you're listening to now, you could come talk to us on Facebook at Facebook.com/opkino, or subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review that we will definitely see. But we'd like the positive ones because those help us find more people around the world.
It's true. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. You can also find the entire show on both Facebook and Twitter at Opkino. And on Twitter or on Facebook, really anywhere, you can answer this week's lightning round question, which is...
what's your favorite movie that prominently features alcohol?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you on Friday.
We are American Made Podcast. And if he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of light. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of light. If he stays, I'll wait for him. Pieces of love. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of light.